Andy is, as you know, is a senior editor with Christianity Today, has had such a great background as a journalist and writer, speaker. My very first exposure to Andy was actually as a reference for someone that had been a friend and partner in work when he was in ministry in Harvard. And so it's been very fun over the years and to kind of continue a conversation and then to pick that conversation up in a variety of different places in a variety of different ways. So we're privileged to have Andy with us as a part of this team that is kind of guiding and helping us as we think together. And I wish you would help me welcome Andy Crouch.
It's always a great privilege to have the coveted late afternoon speaking slot. So I thought we would actually begin not with speaking, but with singing. So you may have thought that this was your chance to relax and sit back and see what this Andy was going to do, but actually we're going to sing together.
Amen. And you may be seated.
In danger of beginning to have church if we went on any longer. Might never get to the content. So what is that? I was with a friend at a conference where we did that song, and he said, "Andy, that just sounds like liberal Protestantism to me." He said, "There must be a God somewhere." He felt very uncomfortable with the vagueness of it. I said, no, don't you understand where this song comes from, where this song begins? Of course, we don't know where it begins. It comes to us out of the mists of American history. You can go on YouTube and hear about 20 different versions of this song because it comes from the oral tradition, right? But where did it begin? If not in some field, some place, somewhere, where a group of people had been subjected to oppression, had been forced to labor and not keep the fruit of their labor. And out in that field, someone starts singing, "In the midst of this situation, I hear music in the air. And in spite of everything I see around me, everything that I can sense or discover through sort of empirical reality here on the ground, there's something in the air, there's something in this world, even in the midst of my situation, that says there must be a God somewhere." So that it's not a declaration of vagueness, it's a declaration of incredible confidence and hope in the midst of what otherwise would just be despair and loss. There must, that long pause, I love that long pause. What is that pause there for? It's to express the tension that's built into these lyrics. There must be a God somewhere. So what is culture? What is culture? Well, you were given the impossible assignment of writing down a definition of culture on the fly. And I had the luxury of having about 6 years to try to work on one, and I ended up stealing one from someone else. The definition I stole it from a wonderful journalist named Ken Myers. And when I heard his definition of culture, after I had read countless sociology and anthropology textbooks that all had like 5 or 6 line definitions of culture, none of which I managed to remember 3 pages later, when I heard Ken's definition, I thought, I can actually remember that. I can work with it. And it actually says everything I would want to say about what culture is. And I especially love it because it has almost no words of more than one syllable, which I find helpful. Ken defines culture this way: what human beings make of the world. Culture is what human beings make of the world. It's all the things that human beings bring out of the raw material of creation and other things that human beings have made. All that they themselves make, that's culture. So that song is culture. It begins with sound waves. It begins with the principles of physics that make certain notes sound consonant and other notes sound dissonant. It begins with the properties of the human voice. There were no pianos when they started out singing that song, I don't think. It's just the human voice, the human hands, the human body, this complicated, wonderful thing called our vocal tract that can make these extraordinary sounds. Some of us make more extraordinary sounds than others. And out of that raw material came a song like that, right? But Ken adds a little kicker to this definition. He says, culture is what human beings make of the world in both senses. It's what we make of the world in both senses. Now, what does he mean? Well, of course, he means that that phrase, make of the world, is ambiguous or means more than one thing at once, really. Because, of course, it can mean the things we make. So that this instrument is culture. It's made out of wood and steel and so forth. It's a piece of culture, a cultural good, we could call it, that some human beings made. The clothes we wear are culture. The room we're in is culture. The computer I'm using, the projector I'm using, all these things are things that human beings make. But culture is not just the things we make. It's also the attempt to make meaning of the world. Culture is the human quest to make something of this world that does not, on the face of it, make much sense. So, we're out in the middle of the field. We're working for another. We don't reap the fruit of our labor. We've been separated from our families, separated from our home, and we are there trying to make something of this world. What in the world does it mean? A world that seems full of music and yet does not come with an explanation. And culture is the human quest to make something of this world that we find ourselves in. Now, what I really love about Ken's definition is that the two senses of making of the world are intertwined. Because the way human beings make meaning of the world is to make things. We make sense by making stuff. So we write songs, we build buildings, we pass laws. All these are cultural artifacts, and they're all driven by a desire to make the world more meaningful than it arrived to us, to make some sense of it. So the meaning making and the stuff making, the thing making, the sense making and the thing making are connected. The way human culture moves along, the way the story progresses, is people ask, what does this mean? And then they make something to answer that. And then what they make is now part of the world that the next generation has to make something of, has to figure out, well, what does that mean? What do I think of that? And the next generation makes more culture. So that the human story, in one way, is just the story of this continual process of people adding more and more cultural goods of greater and greater complexity, in many ways, as we try to make something of the world in both senses of that phrase. So how do we orient ourselves as Christians to this human project of making culture? A project, by the way, which all human beings are engaged in, not just Christians, predates the arrival of Christianity, indeed the arrival of biblical religion by maybe millennia. Human beings trying to make something of the world. What do we make of this project that's going on all around us all the time? Well, I want to try to orient us to that with a simple observation. That what you make of the culture-making project really depends on how big your Bible is. Now, I'm sure all of us have become aware that our working Bibles are smaller than the real Bible. Have you discovered this in your church, in your own devotional life, that there's some parts of the Bible you know backwards and forwards, upside down, right side up? There are other parts that you rarely visit, Leviticus, for example. You don't spend a lot of time in them. And the truth is that everyone's canon is kind of a subset of the real canon, right? Well, I've sort of decided that my own vocation, in a way, is just to restore four chapters to the working canon of American Christians. Four chapters that, in my experience, though of course they're in our printed Bibles and we even hear about them from time to time, I don't think we've taken on board the real implications of these chapters. And they happen to be the first two chapters and the last two chapters. So Genesis 1 and 2, and Revelation 21 and 22. And it's my sense that if we restored these four chapters to our working Bibles, that we might have a very different attitude and perspective on many of the things that trouble us as Christians in North America, including culture. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, first of all, let me just say, what does it mean to have a Bible that begins in Genesis 3 and ends in Revelation 20? Well, of course, that's a Bible that begins with what's in Genesis 3, the fall. So our story begins with the fall. And isn't this often the case, at least for those of us in the kind of tribe called evangelical, that we've often narrated the human story or the biblical story beginning with the bad news of the fall? And then our story moves along through, obviously, lots in the middle, but then ends in Revelation 20, which is, of course, not as well known as Genesis 3, but it's the lake of fire, right? The judgment that's ultimately visited by God upon this desperate human project to declare independence from God in Genesis 3. It ultimately plays out with the destruction of much of the created order and of all the agents of opposition to God. So if that's your story, what's good news? Well, the good news is you don't have to end up in the lake of fire, right? So the good news that we offer is this kind of escape route out of the story. And the good news becomes that there's a way to sort of extract yourself from this story that ends with bad news. You can have the good news that you don't have to be in that story. You can join this kind of heavenly story through the salvation offered by Jesus. And there's a lot of truth in that, and it's not all wrong, and all that's in the Bible. But what happens if we move from Genesis 3 as our starting place to Genesis 1? Well, we could talk a lot about what would happen to our understanding of the gospel, but I'm just going to talk very briefly now about how this would affect our understanding of culture. How do you understand culture if your Bible begins in Genesis 3? Well, all of culture is rebellion. All of culture is the working out of the decision to eat the fruit and to alienate ourselves from God, to declare independence from God. And so then you notice that indeed in Genesis 3, what's the very first thing that the man and the woman do after they eat the fruit? Well, they make clothing. Very inadequate culture, but they make this kind of rudimentary culture to deal with the world the way it is now, to make something of the world. And if you trace from Genesis 3 to 11, you see people making more and more culture that is more and more desperately rebellious against God until we get to Genesis 11, where they make a whole city and a tower whose basic purpose is to thumb our nose at the Creator and make ourselves God, secure ourselves, provide a name for ourselves, do everything that God originally did for us. So if your understanding of culture begins in Genesis 3, it's all about human beings turning away from God. And don't you have the sense that this is often how we talk about the culture in Christian circles? When I hear people talking about the culture when I'm with Christians, I know that the next thing I'm going to hear is some kind of exposition of how the culture has turned away from God, has turned away from truth, how the culture has become, you know, postmodern, post-literate, post-Christian. In other words, it's very easy to just move into critique mode all the time. If your basic framework for culture is, oh, yeah, this is human beings doing what human beings do. They're giving up on God and they're relying on themselves. But what if you began Genesis 1? So I'm in a room of extremely well-read, well-educated people. So rather than me answering that question, let me just take thoughts from you. If we included Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 in how we thought about culture, what materials there, just from your memory of those first two chapters, which I know you've all read and studied, what would we add to our understanding of culture? Does anything come to mind? Yeah.
Everything God created is good, and He made men and women to take dominion and fertility.
Yes, so the basic goodness of the created world, and then the placing of human beings in the world to take care of it and to tell it, exactly. Now that would be part of our storehouse of imagination, not just rebellion. Yeah.
Yeah, the first blessing of God on human beings in Genesis 1:28, the blessing is, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, which is commandments.
Yes, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, which is in a way saying, make something of the world. In other words, culture is actually, and we have this phrase that we use sometimes, the cultural mandate. Steve, I think Steve may have used that phrase. This idea that God actually intends for for humanity not to stay in one place, not to stay in the garden, but to spread out, fill the world as they do so, multiplying not just themselves biologically, but multiplying all the fruits of the world that they find and working with it, making something of it. Yes? Yes, that the world is fruitfully ordered in a way that makes it possible for culture to happen. That the laws of physics make music possible. And it's human beings' glory and delight to sort of explore all the nooks and crannies of the ordered world and bring out of it the fruitfulness that only comes when the chaos is held at bay. The world is not just this kind of chaotic world warring against God. That's actually the Epic of Gilgamesh in many ways, or the Enuma Elish, these competing creation stories. But it's this world of order that rewards human effort and discovery, like an oscilloscope, for example. Anything else come to mind? Just quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here in the second creation account, Adam has all the Adams brought has all the animals brought before him, and his job is to give them names. And I often think of this as the beginning of science in a way. It's taxonomy, you know? And God doesn't say, you know, Adam, this is a camel, this is a cockroach, this is a cockatiel, you know. But God actually steps back and waits to see what Adam will call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. So that culture, in its function of naming, making something of it by naming it, discovering it, explaining it, is a fulfillment of what God asked Adam to do. Isn't this a different vision? Do you get where we're going now? I have to keep moving along. There's probably many more things you'd want to say. What about when we go from the lake of fire to Revelation 21? Well, let me just read a little portion of what Revelation 21 says. About the end of the story. An angel is showing John around this new Jerusalem that comes down from heaven. The wall was made of jasper, and the city of pure gold, as pure as glass. The foundations of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth ruby, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth turquoise, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls, each gate made of a single pearl. The great street of the city was of gold, pure as transparent glass. Now, there's a couple things to notice about this story after the story, what God gives redeemed humanity after the judgment. One is, of course, God's gift to his redeemed world is not a garden. God doesn't just hand humanity back the Garden of Eden and say, well, I've recreated the Garden of Eden, let's start over. God instead gives them a city. And this is striking to me because really, what is a city if not a place where culture has reached kind of critical mass, where culture is flourishing in all these complex ways that it doesn't in a garden, as much as a garden is itself culture. But a city is infinitely more cultured in many more dimensions and directions, you know, upward into skyscrapers, delving into all the different domains of human activity in a way that a garden isn't. And when God wants to give restored humanity the best gift he can think of, he gives them a city. And what is the city furnished with? Well, this long list of jewels, only some of which I know how to pronounce. I'm really not sure I've ever seen a jacinth, but it's probably for the 62nd wedding anniversary or something like that. What is it that this city built by God is adorned with? Well, not minerals, but jewels. What's the difference between a mineral and a jewel? Well, culture. A jewel is a mineral that somebody has made something of. And there's one other feature of this city that I always just thought was kind of exotic heavenly vision talk and not very realistic, which is the streets made of gold as transparent as glass. And I thought, well, that's just John being apocalyptic because there are no such streets, and he's sort of on a kind of a vision trip here, and that must just be metaphorical. And then I got to know this artist named Mako Fujimura. Mako is an abstract expressionist who works, among other things, with gold leaf, beaten squares of gold leaf. And when the gold arrives in Mako's studio, it's already been beaten by the manufacturers of gold leaf to a layer micrometers thin, very, very thin. Mako then layers it on his paintings, and as he's doing so, beats it even thinner, even finer, and layers it over paint that he's already applied to the canvas. Do you know when you treat gold leaf that way, it actually is, I wouldn't say transparent, but translucent. The colors of the paint underneath shine through. And it occurred to me when I was reading Revelation one day, oh my goodness, the art of gold leaf is thousands of years old. John's audience would have known about gold leaf. And when John said gold, pure gold as transparent as glass, they would have thought, oh, you're talking about beaten gold leaf. In other words, cultured gold. Gold that some human artisan has taken and taken out of its just raw form, which is actually not that interesting or striking, and has turned into the absolutely most extraordinary work of art that you can imagine. In other words, the new city is full of culture. It's furnished with culture. What is brought into the new city? The glory and the honor of the nations. The kings of the earth bring their glories into it. Well, what are the glory and honor of the nations if not culture? So, what happens if our picture of culture starts in Genesis 1, ends in Revelation 21, rather than just being about this mordant story in the middle, Genesis 3 to Revelation 20? You would think we would be excited about this. You would think we'd be preaching this and teaching this, but in fact, we do not, for the most part. In fact, most of our congregations get their idea of heaven from the same place that the author of this comment on a Starbucks cup that I got the other day sees it, and here's what he says. This is Joel Stein. He's a kind of a humorist who writes for the LA Times. Heaven is totally overrated. It seems boring. Clouds, listening to people play the harp. It should be somewhere you can't wait to go, like a luxury hotel. Maybe blue skies and soft music were enough to keep people in line in the 17th century, but heaven has to step it up a bit. They're basically getting by because they only have to be better than hell. I read this and I thought, why in the world does Joel Stein think this is what heaven is like? Clouds, listening to people play the harp, boring, only a little better than hell. And I thought, oh my goodness, he thinks this is what heaven is because this is what Christians have told him we think heaven is. Joel Stein is a sort of non-observant Jew. Where did he get this idea? He got it from Christians, that we think this is what we're going to, rather than a world in which all the fruits of human creativity, all the fruitfulness and multiplication of God's image bearers in the world has been brought to fruition, and it's the most extraordinary place, full of music, full of great food, full of artisanship, full of jewelry, perhaps even full of oscilloscopes. That is the world that God wants to give us, not some sort of heavenly, cloudy, vague, harpy kind of place. Over the past century, as we lost this biblical vision of culture, Christians embraced a series of postures toward the human project of culture that have not served us well. I'm going to go through these very rapidly, but partly because they were in the article that was sent to you that you theoretically but surely did not actually read. But you can read about it, and so I'm going to go through it very quickly. The first thing that we kind of learned to do in the 20th century was to condemn culture. This was to complain, to criticize, to point out all the flaws in culture, all the ways that it does reflect the fall, and surely it does. The children of the fundamentalists, who I think were especially pointed in their condemnation of culture, found this a little limiting, and they started to do something a little more subtle, and that was to critique culture. Not to just condemn it outright, but people like Francis Schaeffer, who's pictured here, began to say, no, culture is asking important questions. We ought to actually engage with culture. The fundamentalists said, don't go to the movies, right? We just condemn it outright. There's nothing at the movies worth seeing. You just don't even go near there. That's pagan. Schaeffer said, no, you should go to the movies, especially if they have subtitles and are by, you know, Swedish directors and have complicated themes like death and existentialism, right? And you should actually engage as a Christian with the presuppositions and philosophy that are built into the making of culture. That's critique. And it's a big step up, I think, from condemnation. The only problem is if all you do is critique culture, you aren't really obeying Genesis 1, are you? Which is to actually make it. If all you do is just analyze it, you commit kind of what I call the academic fallacy, with no disrespect to academics, including my wife, who is an academic. But sometimes there's this idea in academia that once you've analyzed something, your job is done. Once you've critiqued it, well, see, I critiqued it, giving me my PhD already. But in the world that God's made, nothing really changes just by critique. It only changes when you add something to the world, when you create something new in light of a critique that's better and that can, as Mark said, displace inadequate culture. Now, this story took a funny turn. In the 1970s in particular, we stopped being so much critics of culture, and we started to think that culture was actually doing some very interesting things that we wanted to get involved with, and we began to do what I would call copying culture. Perhaps the most successful practice of this happened in the realm of music, where people quoted Martin Luther and said, why should the devil have all the good music? Let's make some Christian versions of culture. The problem is not the form of rock and roll, it's the content of rock and roll. So we'll play rock, but we'll sing about Jesus. What this led to was perhaps not so helpful, and I've just offered one example here, and I'll give another later, but this T-shirt, which only some of you will recognize the reference, but it's a takeoff on this T-shirt that plays a big role in the movie Napoleon Dynamite, and some, which the original T-shirt says, vote for Pedro in a high school school body president campaign. Some enterprising Christian T-shirt designer has said, here is an evangelistic opportunity. We can take what the culture is doing and just put Jesus in it and sort of surf the wave of cultural relevance. So now Jesus died for Pedro, and then at the bottom it says, and he died for you too, just to make the point clear. And then because it's not Christian without a scripture verse, underneath in very small type it says Romans 5:8, which of course says in the original Greek, Jesus died for Pedro, and he died for you too. Well, what's happening here? The human calling to create is kind of getting sidelined into this calling to sort of look for something interesting happening in the world out there and quickly run and make a knockoff of it that's used as a sort of evangelistic tool. What's the problem with this? Well, one problem is if this is your approach to culture, you are always going to be waiting to see what culture does and then try to do it after culture, which means you'll always be a few steps behind culture. So that back when FM radios could actually be tuned by turning a little dial, I'd be able to tune through the FM dial if I was in a strange city, and I would know that I was at the Christian music station, no disrespect to my friends who produced some of this stuff, I would know I was at the Christian music station before I heard the lyrics, because the style of music being played was from like 4 years previous. Right? So if boy bands had been really big 4 years ago, now we had like a Christian boy band. Right? But that means you're never actually adding to culture. You're just kind of tagging along with culture. These days, I think most Christians neither condemn nor critique nor feel that comfortable with copying. I think mostly what we do is just consume culture. Whatever the culture offers us, I mean, the fundamentalist qualms about going to the movies have been replaced by a willingness to go to whatever's on and not come out and have deep existential Francis Schaeffer LaBrie-style conversations about it, but just, you know, ask the basic question that all Americans now ask, you know, did you like it? You know, and you either liked it or you didn't like it. And that's the consumer's response, ooh, I liked that. Nom, 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 more, you know, and then, or, oh, I didn't like that, yuck. And we've lost the ability to critique. We just consume. And when I'm with Christians around the country, I sometimes think we consume culture more avidly and assiduously than our neighbors just to show that we're really relevant. The problem with all these postures is that they all react to culture. None of them are about the two things that human beings are actually called to do, which are, first of all, to cultivate, to take care of the world, to till it and keep it. I sometimes call cultivating keeping what is good, good. Every spring we have gardens around our house, and we have to go out there and cultivate those gardens to keep the annuals that, or are they perennials? The perennials. You can tell I'm not allowed to do this work, actually, because I can't tell the difference between an annual, perennial, and a weed. But my wife and daughter, who are master gardeners, go out and they cultivate the ground to keep that good garden good, to keep that little corner of the world in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, at least as good as it was last year. And I ask myself, are Christians in our society known as the people who want to keep it at least as good as it already is? Who care about the things that are in our society that are actually pretty good, and we want to keep them flourishing? Or are we just known as people who are always complaining and wanting to take over and do our own thing? Are we known as cultivators? And then, of course, not just to cultivate, but as Mark mentioned, to create, to actually add to the store of culture in the world, to add names, to call living creatures things they've never been called before, to discover how many more species of beetles are in the world than we ever knew, right? That's part of our basic calling, to add to the world. So here's a question. When you think about your own organization, whatever it may be, and you think about the cultural context it's in, how would you describe your organization's posture towards culture? Is it a suspicious posture? Is it an imitative posture? Is it largely just consuming, kind of drafting along with whatever culture is doing? Are there elements of cultivating and creating in it? And by the way, you can answer this question with a word that does not begin with the letter C. You are allowed to branch out to B and D on either side. Let's hear from a couple of you what came to mind as you shared with your neighbors. If you're willing and can speak up fairly loudly so that those across the room can hear you, what came to mind when you thought about your organization's posture towards culture?
We ended up with R word. Restoring is really a lot of what we do.
Restoring
people to relationships.
Beautiful. Yeah. So seeing the kind of alienation in culture and seeking to knit people back together, is that what you were thinking in particular? And generations back together. Wow, beautiful. It's a wonderful word. Yes?
The marketplace.
Bringing truth to the marketplace. So offering our culture something true in a setting, especially the marketplace, where often people may not have other sources of that. Yeah, great. Others? And I suspect that would be true for many of us in this room. And I think one of the challenges for leadership for many of us is navigating between those two instincts, right? The constituency that really wants to see us kind of taking a stand against and maybe is sort of has a distorted vision of what that requires. And then a generation that wants to see us embracing, and that also may have a kind of distorted vision of what the Christian calling is. And that is a tricky thing to lead in the middle of. One or two more thoughts that came to mind, maybe that are different from those. Yes?
So,
yeah, beautiful. Because God's original intention is for cultural diversity. That's not an accident or a kind of plan B. That's actually what God originally intends. Be fruitful and multiply would mean that human beings move into every biome, every part of the world, and naturally cultural diversity would have to come from that. But instead, what happens in Genesis 11 is people try to lock down that process. They all settle in one place. They try to build this tower, try to create cultural homogeneity. And God frustrates that by creating all the multiple languages so that his original plan of multiplied cultural diversity can happen. So that it's possible to see Genesis 1 as an affirmation of cultures that often have felt stifled under cultural homogeneity. That's a beautiful example. Yeah, one last comment on this topic. I think that's beautifully put. Joy and angst, joy and sorrow at the reality of culture, but also joy in culture. Rather than just narrow critique or condemnation or imitation or too easy consumption, taking it seriously enough to celebrate it and to mourn what culture does to God's image bearers. So where are we? I want to give us a couple ways of orienting ourselves to this project of making culture. And the first we've already covered, that really the story we should be telling about culture is not one primarily, first of all, of human rebellion, though that is part of culture. I'll talk about it in a few minutes. But that really where we orient ourselves is God's image bearers in all their intended diversity, in a very good world, a world that God has never said, well, I regret having made that world. The world is no longer very good. God never says that in the Bible. I want to offer up another thought that I think is especially important for leaders to understand about culture, which is that when you think about culture, you've got to understand that form matters. And I would probably add, form matters more than content. When we think about culture, in my experience, especially in Christian settings, we often talk primarily about the content of culture. That is the message that it's delivering. So we're talking a lot about entertainment here these 2 days. And when we think of entertainment, we think of the messages, that is the content that are being delivered to especially young people who are very influenced by popular culture. And I'm not saying we should neglect the content and the overt or even under the surface messages that may be transmitted. But when you start looking at what people make of the world, you quickly realize that the forms they create are much more durable and consequential than the message that's conveyed in those forms. And let me give you one really clear example relating to music. This is an ancient technology that some of you recognize and some of you used to prize with all your heart, right? The 45 RPM single. One of the most influential cultural forms of the 20th century, certainly in the world of music, probably the most influential cultural form. And think about what this cultural form did. This was a vinyl disc that was played at 45 revolutions a minute, a little needle traced around the edge and in towards the center, right? And what did that form create? Well, it created the 3.5-minute pop song. Why? Because you can't fit more than 3.5 minutes on a 45 RPM, right? So whatever music you're going to put on this disc is going to be limited by the physical characteristics of the disc. The form of the disc is going to mean that song is going to be at a maximum 4 minutes long. What did that do to American popular music? Think about how different that is, for example, from the music of the Gershwins or the music of Noel Coward or the great songwriters of the first half of the 20th century, pre-45s, who wrote multi-verse songs that could take you through a whole long story, right? And you could have like 6 or 7 verses that would come back to a chorus. That would be one form that was very popular. But with the 45, you basically got room for what? Verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, outro, fade. And that's your song. Well, so why is it that popular culture, when it sings about love, sings such adolescent things about love? Always sings about adolescent love, never sings about mature love, never sings about love that's lasted for decades or even the 16 years that my wife and I have eked out so far. You know, why is it that I can't find any pop music, really, about my relationship to my wife? Well, because it has to fit in 3.5 minutes. You just can't tell those kind of stories very often. You're not inclined to tell those kind of stories when you have such a constrained medium. Now, is it strictly speaking impossible? No, and Charlie Peacock is one who's done it. But most writers were so constrained by this form that the content they delivered really was already decided before they wrote a single word. It was a 3.5-minute experience of sort of anticipation, climax, release that's very compressed and that doesn't really represent that much of human experience, but that's what popular music had to work with. Now, this happens in a lot of other ways. The form of culture shapes us in so many ways. There's something that has shaped the ministry that every person in this room is involved in, maybe more, certainly more than the 45 RPM record, maybe more than any other single thing in 20th century history, a form that the United States created. It's the interstate highway. Just the fact that we rearranged the transportation system of our highway in the 1950s and 60s around these interstates shaped everything every one of us does. I wish I had time to go into that, but I don't. But trust me, the interstates have shaped, they've shaped suburbs, they've shaped cities, they've shaped rural areas, they've allowed some cities to flourish, they've allowed others to dwindle and diminish. They've changed what people expect about where they live, where they play, where they work, how they live, play, work. There's nothing more consequential than the interstates. They don't have any content at all. There's no content to an interstate. It's all form, and it's the most single most consequential decision that our government made domestically in the 20th century. Think about politics. Why is American politics so polarized? This is the 17th congressional district in Illinois. Is sometimes fondly referred to as the rabbit on a skateboard, right? I especially like this barely is even connected to the rest of this district. What does this do? This is the process, the form that our politics takes are these gerrymandered districts that are designed to generate reliable seats for whichever party did the redistricting, has nothing to do with the content of politics, and yet this form shapes our political life in very profound ways. The fact that that district is shaped that way shapes what kind of content can ever be heard in that district. What happens when Christians don't pay attention to form? and think that form is neutral and all that matters is content. Well, then we take just any form from the culture and we fill it with Christian content and we think our job's done. So, another t-shirt. You may recognize this cultural form. Do you know what it is? The Staples Easy Button. Isn't it terrifying how almost all of us know what that is? Right? The Staples Easy Button is a plastic button that when you push it does absolutely nothing except relieve a little bit of frustration. And some enterprising Christian has said, well, that form will work. We'll just slap Jesus on it. Which prompts me to ask, is there anything Jesus is less like than a plastic button you can push when life's problems, one solution, it's that easy? I mean, is there anything Jesus is less like than that kind of button? I have not come up with anything. And so, in fact, when you try to cram the content of Jesus into the form of a technological society that expects a button to solve every problem, you completely empty the content of Jesus of any real meaning, and all you do is just reinforce what the culture is telling ourselves, that there's an easy way out of every problem. And now we just have a name for it, and it's Jesus. But that's nothing to do with what Jesus actually offers you in the face of life's problems. He doesn't really offer solutions. He offers something harder and better than a solution, something much better than a button that doesn't even work. What we have not recognized is that culture is largely built not on messages, but on the medium, not on the media in which it shapes our hopes and fears. And so I thought it would be good for us to think about this. In your cultural context, the place where you live, work, minister, lead, what forms most deeply shape, and I might add articulate or sort of give voice to people's hopes and fears? What forms condition the way people move and work in the world? If you're in a corporate context, this might be the cubicle. If you're in a suburb, it might be the cul-de-sac. If you're in a city, it may be different patterns of policing. There'll be many different answers to this, but let's turn to that same group you were just with and spend a few minutes on this. What cultural forms are shaping people's hopes and fears where you are? Go ahead. So I'd love to hear from just a couple people. What came to mind as you think about forms that shaped your cultural context? Yes.
Well, I work at a high school, so I was just immediately thinking about sports. And sports.
Yes.
Yes. How it shapes the school. So
yes.
That was an example.
Great example. And by the way, it's very important. You know, you got very quickly to the, I think, the proper ambivalence. There's some really good things about these forms. Almost all cultural forms have some real residual image bearing in them. But then they also, we sense, sometimes misshape people. And that will be true of almost everything we'll probably have to say. Yeah, what else? What other forms shape people where you are? Yes.
We talked about the iPad and the iPhone and the iTunes. Like, it's a form, but it's shaping.
Absolutely. This, you know, we call it a form factor, this shape. What can fit on this? What can I interact with on this? What can I interact with in the shape of an iPad or another digital device? Absolutely, very powerful forms. The form matters way more than whatever is on that screen in many ways. One or two more? Something maybe quite different for those two? Yes.
Social media.
Ah, yes,
absolutely.
Yes.
It's what it does to you in terms of creating the good, the great relationships that you can reconnect with, but the great cyber relationships which are not real relationships.
Yes, the complexity of what it looks like even to have relationships in a world where many relationships are mediated through Facebook and so forth. We used to have this self-congratulatory saying in the media world when we were moving into the web era. We said, content is king. And it turns out to be totally not true. Facebook has no content. Facebook themselves provide no content to you. All they provide you is a screen on which to project your fantasies, your fears about who's your friend, who's not your friend, how are you connected to the world. And it's all about form. Yeah, very, very influential, for better and for worse. Wow, yes, you're very right. That's parents. The parents are the source of the fears and the hopes. Yes, they are, and we need to not neglect this. You know, as much as I think media, iPads are all very important forms, I don't think we need to give up give up the ghost, as if actually family is not still profoundly formative for culture. And for the culture, if we work with young people, even if they seem quite detached from their families, more and more as we study them, we come to understand they're not at all. When we start talking about these forms that have shaped people, we feel this sense of tension, right? Because we know, and I'm going to have to, I have to admit, skip over the best part of my talk, just in the interest of honoring your time. No, I don't think it is, but now Sharon has put me on the spot. I'll come back to it tomorrow. We'll talk a little more about how this image has been broken. We sense that this image-bearing capacity of human beings to do what God does in the world, to tend the world and to create in the world, has been distorted in kind of fundamental ways in the culture around us. So that our Genesis 3 to Revelation 20 story is not wrong, it's just incomplete, kind of crucially incomplete, but it's not wrong. What do we do with that? Is there hope for restoring the image, restoring this God-given vocation to create fruitful, multiplying, flourishing culture? Well, in order to get at this for the last minutes that we have together today, I thought we would actually look at actually a restored image. So I'm going to ask that we turn down the lights, and we're going to spend a little bit of time with this painting by the American painter Henry Osawa Tanner. The name of the painting is The Banjo Lesson, painted in 1893. And what I'm going to do now is just give you a chance to do something that probably most of you don't do in your day-to-day lives, but I'm going to give you a chance just to contemplate this painting in silence, to look at it, to just let it strike you in whatever way it does, to notice whatever you notice about it, ask whatever questions may come to mind as you look at it, and just observe it for about 90 seconds in silence. And by the way, just like in a museum, if you're towards the back and you can't see it very well, feel free to just sort of wander up here and get a closer look so that we all get a chance, as well as we can with the media we have here, to interact with Henry Tanner's painting. So I'm gonna give you a minute and a half just to reflect on what this painting may say to you and to us together. So we'll keep the lights down. And let's just talk a little bit. Again, speak up so that we'll all be able to hear what you say. And let's just begin with a very broad question. What struck you about this painting? What did you notice? What surprised you or intrigued you as you spent a little time contemplating it? Yes?
Incredible detail.
The detail, and were there any details that struck you in particular? Yeah, so he's detailed the table in the back. He's got the table in the front as well, or it might be a stove here in front. Yeah, a lot. There's a lot in this painting. Yeah, what else? Yes. Yeah, and it's interesting how you did what I think a lot of us do, is you try to figure out what's the relationship between these two individuals, and many of us sense this is a grandfather and a grandson. That seems somehow right. And then we start to think of the whole story behind this moment and what's being handed on here, the culture that's being handed on from one generation to another. Yeah, what else? Yes. Oh my goodness. Beautiful. Wonderful. And made you appreciate it. What do you mean? Wow. And isn't that so often what art does, is it gets us to slow down and realize that these moments that just sort of blink by in our lives actually are pregnant with significance, are full of meaning, if we would stop and attend to them in the way that Henry Tanner invites us to do. Yes, beautifully put. Others? If I can't see your hand, just speak up. Yes. It is quite extraordinary how we sense that the boy, if you asked the boy what was happening at this moment, he would say, I was playing the banjo. And you were, young man. And yet, the grandfather is in crucial ways supporting and enabling and maybe even fingering a few things so that it's possible for the boy to have that rich experience of playing. He hasn't left him to his own devices. He hasn't just handed in the banjo and says, oh, go learn how to play this. He's involving himself in a way that makes it possible for the boy to have his own personal experience of playing, supported almost invisibly by his grandfather. Yeah.
There are at least two sources of life.
Ah, we have a real art critic in the room who notices what many artists notice when they look at this painting. Do you want to add what you see? Or from behind indicating history, from the front indicating future, extra bonus art critic points. The other thing that those of you who are painters, even if you've just dabbled, you'll notice is the different color of the two lights. One blue, the bluish light that comes from a window. The other warm yellow orange that comes from a stove. And it's masterful how Tanner holds these two forms of light together rather than just using one source, which is a much easier thing to paint. Yes. Yeah. There's so much more we can say about this, but I want to tell you why I show it to you. And I show it to you for two reasons. One is that I'm, as Steve mentioned, I'm writing a book on power, which is also has to be along the way about leadership as well. And I really think this is an extraordinary picture of what the best leadership does. It's intimate, it involves a relationship of trust, it is supportive, and yet it makes room for creativity. This grandfather is leading in the sense that he's making room, he's creating an environment where his grandson can experience what it is to be a flourishing human being. Sure, go ahead. Why did we assume it's the grandfather? Fair enough. What were your thoughts about that? Yes, this could be I think it's really helpful that you point out this painting is not painted at a time of just sort of simple, intact families that have the sort of privilege and luxury of passing on culture in a very kind of normal way. They operate in an environment of tremendous disruption, so it's hard to say what the relationship is between these two. We're viewing it kind of through a middle class. We've got grandparents, and they hand it on. I think you're quite right. And that actually leads to the second reason I wanted to show this, because this painting is a profound act of culture making in an environment of broken images. And let me explain, presuming on your time, just for a couple more minutes. This is Henry Tanner, the painter of this painting. Henry Tanner, as can be seen in this painting by his teacher, Thomas Eakins, the great Philadelphia figure painter, was of African descent. His father was eventually a bishop in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Henry Tanner, as much as his parents tried to discourage him from being an artist, as all good faithful parents do to their children, ended up studying with Eakins, spent part of his time at the Philadelphia Academy, but eventually left, many people believe, because he would never have been allowed to graduate with a diploma from the Philadelphia Academy as an African-American. He eventually moved to France, where he found international renown, the first African-American painter to be exhibited in the salons in France, and became a very, very influential painter. And in order to really understand what's going on in the banjo lesson, we have to understand who Henry Tanner was and what he painted, because he painted a banjo lesson. The banjo was not a neutral cultural image at this time. The banjo was actually the image of minstrelsy, of African-Americans or Anglo-Americans dressed in blackface, presenting a kind of a caricature of black culture for the entertainment of dominant culture audiences. And if you had asked late 19th century American of any color or race or ethnicity what they thought of when they thought of the banjo, they probably would have thought of something like this. This caricature by an unknown, and we don't need to know who it is because it's not very good, artist, contemporary with Tanner's painting. And although it's kind of painful to do this, I really find it helpful to put these two images next to one another. Keeping in mind that on the left is the dominant image of what it is to be a musical African-American. And on the right is what Henry Tanner paints in response. As we look at these two images, what do you notice? What do you notice about the image on the left compared to the image on the right? Just maybe a couple observations. The image on the left has no human feeling for this figure. And that's shown in the cheapness of the art. It's a cheap drawing. It's tossed off. Yes, sorry? Flat. It's flat. Very little depth, very little dimension. Compare it to the extraordinary careful depth of field in Tanner's painting, the three-dimensionality of Tanner's painting, as against this almost two-dimensional rendering of the cartoonist. There's the image that Tanner paints is an image with harmony in it, with wholeness in it, This image on the left is of an isolated individual. He's on a stage. You can very faintly see the audience behind him. He's separated from others. He's distinguished from others. Yeah. The eyes of this figure on the left are very sad. Even though he's entertaining, he has a kind of a grimace, trying to act happy. But this artist, both probably for lack of skill and with a certain amount of realism, shows this is a very desperate situation to be in, to have to perform in this way. Whereas on the right, there's no forced emotion. There's no feigned emotion. It's all real emotion, appropriate emotion, human emotion. And we have to honestly admit that many of the people who would have taken the left image for granted, and that was their cultural world, that was the forms that they inhabited, would have called themselves Christians. They were part of the culture. So I want to get rid of that caricature and just spend one more moment with Tanner here. What was he doing? He was restoring an image. He was taking an image that had been broken by culture. The very image of the banjo. He could have painted anything. Henry Tanner painted a lot of other things, many of them incredible biblical scenes. He chose to paint the very thing that represented culture's twisted, distorted vision of what people were, and say, no, no, I want to show you what evangelism is really like. I want to show you what culture really can be, what image bearing really is. And he did this as a Christian artist. Now, the interesting thing is that caricature, I mean, the only reason, you'll never see it again. It's nothing. It's evanescent. Even though it represented the dominant culture of the time, it's chaff which the wind has blown away. This image is enduringly valuable so that we could spend another 3 hours together and we wouldn't fully plumb the depths of what Henry Tanner is saying to us in it. He created culture that was so excellent that as long as people talk about American painting, they'll talk about Henry Tanner. So this is what we're about, friends, is in a world of broken images, restoring an image. I think it would be good for us to end worshiping the one who is the image who we bear, using this very simple hymn that at the end gets really complex and beautiful. So I'd actually like to ask you to stand, we'll sing, and then Sharon will give us a few thoughts, and then we'll have a break before dinner. So Father, we thank you so much for what you may have had to say to us in this time, and we want to respond to you and just name what's true about your world and what's true about you as we worship.
I must say that this particular soul that was formed in Baptist soil and now dwells in Quaker company is very grateful for all the music. I suggested that Steve embodies one of the hungers of our time, the hunger for compassionate leadership. And I want to suggest that Andy also embodies one of the deep hungers in our time, and that is for contemplative leadership. It might seem counterintuitive that that is the word that comes up when I experience what how Andy's vocation takes form in the world. Because he's a very animated guy. He's not our stereotype of a meditating monk. But I think we know as he works among us and invites us that he has spent a good deal of contemplative time and invites us as well as into contemplative space. It has already been quoted that a leader's first job is to define reality. And the way that we talk about that within the work of adaptive leadership is with less sublime language and simply the language of the importance of getting off the dance floor and getting to the balcony. And you might imagine a grand ballroom this size or even larger And in the other earlier architecture, balconies encircling it. And we know there are some things you will never know about the dance if you're not dancing. But there are things that you will never know about the dance unless you take the time to go to the balcony and to read the patterns. And then you have more choices about how you want to re-enter the dance and perhaps affect the dance. We sometimes refine that to saying that part of the work of leadership in our time is to go to the balcony and interrogate reality, and that includes reading the deep patterns, and then, only then, re-entering. And recognizing, as one of the people we interviewed for our book, Common Fire, Leading Lives of Commitment in a Complex World, one person said, in the complexity in which we live, if you think of it in a mechanistic model, complexity can be dangerous. But if you think of it in an organic model, that not problems can metastasize, but also solutions can metastasize. And the work is to find a way of intervening in the system so that the system itself, the culture itself, can regain health. There was a young woman who was invited by a national Lutheran body to come to a youth congress. And she was particularly invited because she, at the age of 18, had suffered a serious accident in playing basketball. And she was in a wheelchair and would be for the rest of her life. And this group, out of Christian Impulse, was wanting to remember that justice is a matter of who's included and who's excluded. And they invited her to come and be a part. And she got there, and she had been a bit dubious about going because at the time she was a little uneasy with the stance of the church towards women. But she knew they were trying to do a good thing, and she thought she should cooperate. She got there, and there was another young woman also in a wheelchair. It was announced that on Friday night there would be a dance. These two young women looked at each other and wondered whether or not they would go. They decided they would attend, and they were there, and they were seated at the edge of things. And then a young man came over and invited this first young woman to ask her if she would like to dance, and she said yes. So he wheeled her out into the middle of the dance floor, and then he went and got a chair, and he sat down across from her, and they began to dance. Another young man went to the other young woman in the wheelchair and invited her to dance. They did the same thing. It was only a moment later before 500 young people went for the chairs around the side of the room, and pretty soon all of them were dancing, sitting down. A young man had mentally gone to the balcony. He had read the patterns on the dance floor. He had made a choice about how he might so act as to re-enter the dance in a way that might change the dance. This young woman I began telling you about is now in medical school at Duke University, the first woman, the first person to go through medical school in a wheelchair, and she thinks that maybe Lutherans have something to offer. Contemplation in action is what the Jesuits have always called it. That in the art and practice of leadership, that we are to be contemplatives. And part of the art is to sort of simultaneously be able to be on the dance floor and also get to the balcony and come back into the dance. I have a colleague who is a consultant to a number of companies and organizations, and he says, most of the places I go, people are dancing themselves to death. They need time on the balcony, and they don't even know where the balcony is. Andy has clearly spent time reading the patterns. He has spent time with sacred scripture. He has spent time looking at history, looking at shifts in history over time, from condemning to critiquing to copying to condemning. My notes here are a mess. You'll have to bear with me. And he has spent time contemplating forms. And in so doing, he has helped us to get to the balcony. When we go to the balcony and read the patterns, one of the questions that then we want to begin to ask is, where is the adaptive work located? And he has shown us how one man, a painter named Tanner, identified where the adaptive work was located, that there needed to be a new image, a new story about who we are and how we more appropriately dwell together. It has been said that next to a banjo, the most potent instrument of cultural change is a story. Clearly, he got those two things together, and he found a way to paint a new story to take form among us. This was to offer adaptive leadership. Adaptive not in the sense of get along and go along, but adaptive in the sense of how are we more faithful? How do we create more adequate meaning? How do we create a more just and viable world for all of us into the future? There are two other distinctions that are offered to our imagination as we think about leadership from this perspective. And one is a distinction between power and progress. We human beings are infinitely fascinated with power. Who has it? Who's going to get it? Who's deferring? Who's abusing? Who's so forth? And power is not an irrelevant question. And you and I have a particular vantage point from which to look at questions of power. But perhaps the deeper question is always not so much who has the power, but if we're in swamp territory, whoever has positional power may not be the one in any given moment who's actually helping us find the way through. The deeper question is, who's helping us to make progress? You all know this in your own experience, what we mean by what it means to be there in a way that helps us to make progress. And it draws us to another distinction, which is a distinction between our preoccupation in leadership conversations about leadership personalities, various traits and so forth that we assume are the gifts that lead to leadership, and more, what is the quality of presence that one is able to be within a complex system. And there's a important book in leadership studies now entitled Presence that comes out of the work being done at MIT with Peter Senge and Otto Schumer and others. But the sense of presence is very much a sense of what is the posture. And all of you have been in situations where you're present in a group this size, smaller or larger, and you are about to say something brilliant. And then someone speaks just before you, and you realize that they have just said something very important to the life of that group. And as an act of leadership, you choose to hold your comment, to give room, to give space to that other comment that was made, to see how it might move and what it might make possible. Perhaps you choose to be silent, or perhaps you choose to join it in some way, giving it further energy. Part of one's posture is the desire to make progress within the life of the group, doing so from wherever you sit. Andy is doing that as a journalist. Tanner did it as an artist. part of what we see is that we are now having to think about leadership in a vertical world gone horizontal. For eons as a species, we have asked that ancient question, that meaning-making question, who are we under these stars? Knowing what we now know, the question has become slightly different. Who are we among these stars? All that we are learning from space exploration is dramatically changing our world, and in a changing cosmology, we are shifting, and it means that our imagination of who we are together in this universe begins to shift, and a vertical world in the complexity of our time begins to go horizontal. As we talked about the posture at our table, and we were asked the question, what is your posture in relationship to culture? One of the things that came to my mind was that image that actually Heifetz, a Jew, uses out of his contemplation of looking at a crucifix on the day of Yom Kippur when he was trapped in Christian country and went into a chapel. And he came out saying that what he saw was that sign that he took as a leader embraces it all, the whole world. And then at our table, as we were talking, there's a college president, Andrea Cook, and then Mimi Bernard works with CIC. This time I got the names. And they were talking about that the posture of many Christian colleges in the past has been to be a certain kind of bubble that provided a certain powerful mentoring environment, but separated from the whole, separated from that larger world and all the others that God loves. And then I was thinking about how earlier this fall, I was invited to be a keynoter for a national meeting of the college of the directors of counseling centers on college and university campuses from across our country. And in preparation for that, I learned what probably some of you already know, and that is that every year on our college and university campuses, taken as a collective, 1,800 students die because of alcohol-related accidents and behavior. 1,800. Over a two-year period, it would be more than died in the World Trade Centers on 9/11. And I find myself, as I sat with that particular statistic, being especially grateful for all of the organizations, some represented here, who provide on our college and university campuses an alternative sociality that is an attractor to young people who would like to be together in a different kind of way than some of the pressures, and the deaths do not represent also the attendant vandalism, sexual exploitation, et cetera, et cetera. And, but then I was thinking, but there's all the rest of the campus. And part of what we know in adaptive leadership is that you may often have to act beyond your authorization. And the question comes when we are asked about the wider culture. How do we provide not only those enclaves that provide an alternative to the culture, but how do we speak to the culture in language that the culture can understand and where we can meet together to create the good story, the better story, the more faithful story of who we are invited to be together. Andy, thank you for your contemplative leadership and for inviting all of us to the balcony.